This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the best of Fight Back from the week that was. It was a week ago yesterday, Princess Catherine announced in a video that she has cancer and is undergoing preventative chemotherapy after her abdominal surgery in January. The video came after an inordinate amount of speculation and conspiracy theories around her condition, and after that infamous photoshopped picture of the Princess of Wales and her children. Her video announcement also prompted a huge outpouring of sympathy around the world. Joining Libby on Monday to talk about the latest royal development, Suzanne Boyd, editor-in-chief and publisher of Zoomer Magazine and everythingzoomer.com.
It's something that we go back and forth on with the monarchy, this idea of transparency versus privacy, this vision of, their aspirational family, you have to look up to them. So they're real, but they can't be too real. And they're on the public purse. So what do they owe us in terms of information, the British public and people in the Commonwealth who are supposedly the subjects? So it's just the PR from the beginning to the end has just been a boondoggle. I mean, the confluence of events around the King's health at the same time, Kate's health, the fact that, you know, I just go back to the Queen so often on these things where she said, you know, she acted, never complain, never explain. Now they have to explain. And she also said, I have to be seen to be believed. And, you know, this was the issue. One of the most followed, thought about prominent women in the world disappears. And she says she's disappearing. But then these conspiracy theories start online. And then the photo, I think the photo just made everything explode. And then it really forced them to change course and I think led to her having to make the statement, which I think was a positive thing that she did eventually make it in the end.
What do you think this means? I mean, you know, the Queen had her way of dealing with it, but she didn't have social media to deal with.
Well, yes, and not till the end. But, those tabloid fires that she dealt with in the 90s and, you know, around the death of Diana, yeah. Where it almost felt where you have to say something where, you know, when they stayed up at the castle with the boys after Diana died and she didn't come down from Windsor to Buckingham Palace and the people said, you have to say something. And I felt it was very much that situation for the royal family, but it was happening on social media instead of people outside the palace, literally at the gates of the palace, shouting, holding up signs, so this was social. It was happening on social media for Kate. And it felt that it really was the respect and the belief in the institution and that she really had to come forward. I think it was that much of an issue after the PR fail of the photo. And so that's why the statement was necessary.
I'd just like to ask, sort of compare and contrast the way this came out for the King and what happened with her while she was trying harder not to disclose.
Well, I think, you know, the cover-up is always worse, and I think the photo was the problem. I think, again, the King being the constitutional monarch, the head of state, had to be more forthcoming, and he did promise that he would have a formal, informal, more transparent reign than his mother's reign. Because we know royals have had health problems. No one knew that George VI had cancer. You know, no one knew the Queen had blood cancer until after she died. So it's he was so forthcoming. With her, I do think it's a bit different because, again, she's not the constitutional monarch. But what it shows is that in the older days, there was one palace structure of PR and communications. It all came from Buckingham Palace and all the other Clarence House at the time, which when he was Prince Charles, Kensington Palace, which is William and then Prince Harry when he was still in the royal family, working royal family fold. It all came from one place, but then all those PR operations were separated out. And, you know, so they're not speaking as one. So Kensington Palace has one way, which is Kate and William, as opposed to Buckingham Palace, which is the King's. They have different comms and different approaches. And there's also the Prince William factor, who is deeply, deeply private and does not like the media because of how they treated his mother, and has an aversion to sharing a lot and being as open as perhaps his father is. So I think all those together has made it very... Made it different. But as we saw, her coming forward was a step in the right direction in terms of people understanding, and probably she will now get the privacy she wants and I believe she deserves.
Suzanne Boyd, editor-in-chief and publisher of Zoomer Magazine and everythingzoomer.com. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. This past Monday, the four suspects in the deadly Crocus Concert Hall attack in Moscow appeared in court and were charged with committing a terrorist act. ISIS, specifically ISIS-K, has released a gruesome video, but the disinformation campaign by Russian leader Vladimir Putin is well underway. A headline in The Economist may have said it best. Putin has begun Operation Blame Ukraine and has stepped up the military campaign as well. Libby was joined by two experts to discuss. Dr. Andriy Zayarnyuk is professor of history at the University of Winnipeg, and Dr. Maria Popova is associate professor of political science at McGill University.
Putin actually went on TV after he received this U.S. intelligence and accused the U.S. of trying to destabilize Russia. You would think that right now he has egg on his face, but he never feels this way and never apologizes for anything. In every crisis, he first hides for about 24 hours and then comes up with an explanation that tries to shift the blame away from his government, which in this case basically has completely mismanaged the situation. They got this warning and they didn't do anything about it.
Dr. Zayarnyuk, do you agree they mismanaged the situation?
Well, yes, there is plenty of information about police actually being on the scene of the attack and basically just running away. And also with the fire in the building, the way special forces behaved. I mean, what we saw was basically just a show of brutality, you know, the cut ears, tortured suspects, but no efficiency. And yes, they ignored the warning. They officially announced that, you know, it's a disinformation by the West. So, yeah, Russian special services, Russian government showed very poor performance in all of this.
Dr. Popova, Putin's thing is that he is on top of security. He will protect Russia and the Russian people. So how bad is this for him? And do you think there might be any consequence?
You know, of course, it is bad in the sense that he has shown his government to not be actually competent in assuring security. But I think we need to remember that this has happened many times in Russia before, during his 24 years in power. This is not the first terrorist attack. Unfortunately, not even the worst one in terms of death toll. But he is unlikely to be really punished by Russian society, by the electorate. That's just really not how Russia works. We tend to think of situations like this through our own lens, which is sort of, you know, if the government does a really poor job, we vote against it, or, you know, we organize against it. And in fact, in Russia, we haven't seen, even though there have been plenty of terrorist attacks over the years, we haven't seen really major mobilization and major blame directed towards Putin. The blame is likely going to be directed at lower level management.
Dr. Zayarnyuk, what happens next?
Well, the same thing we've seen for the last 2 years. You know, every day Russia will kill hundreds, actually, on the front line. I mean, we are drawn to this terrorist attack because it happened in Moscow, you know, far away from the front line. But the thing to remember is that we have 150 people killed on a good day and twice as many on a bad day. And it's been going on for 2 years, so nothing changed. The terrorist attack in Moscow did not actually interrupt Russian attacks against Ukrainian cities. There was not even a pause there. So I don't see how this will change anything.
Dr. Andriy Zayarnyuk, professor of history at the University of Winnipeg, and Dr. Maria Popova, associate professor of political science at McGill University. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, the rising cost of private agency nurses. What to do about it? That is coming up next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Since the pandemic, we've heard a lot about the increasing use of expensive private agency nurses because of regular staff shortages in hospitals and long-term care homes. Now we have a number on it. The governing Ford PCs at Queen's Park spent nearly $1 billion of public money on agency nurses last year. What are the consequences and what can be done to decrease the cost? On Tuesday, Libby was joined by two stakeholders for a discussion. Jane Midas is a staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly. And Lisa Levin is CEO of Advantage Ontario.
If we're talking about long-term care or home and community care, there often aren't gold-plated pensions unless they work, for example, for a municipal long-term care home. And so that's part of the issue. The salaries are lower in community care and long-term care than in hospitals. And also the morale has gone down because people see their colleagues leaving and going to work for a temporary agency, coming back sometimes the next day, back to work in the home, choosing the shifts they want and making more money.
Jane, what kind of complaints, what kind of issues have you dealt with that involve people coming in from an agency? And does this apply to personal support workers coming from an agency?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people in long-term care, as you pointed out, many of them do have dementia. And so they don't know if something is being done incorrectly, like you or I might if we were, you know, in healthcare and see a wrong medication or something. So we certainly hear reports from our capable residents as well as from family members about incorrect medication being given, improper care, getting the wrong food, not being fed properly. So a person, you know, might need a certain kind of diet or have to, you know, have a choking issue. These staff, you know, are coming in. They don't know all about the ins and outs of these people that can be very complex and that require very specific kinds of care. They don't know if this person has a trauma that perhaps when they're being bathed, there's a certain issue or a certain way to provide that care. And frankly, they don't have the time to come in and read the files of all the residents that they're going to be having to be cared for. They're going to have to care for. So, you know, we have a huge problem. They are often not identified. So residents will ask them their name. They don't wear name tags. It's a huge problem. And the care is not good. And we really have to look at this. You know, people in long-term care, the staff are not paid properly. They never have been. They've always been the poor sisters of the younger, of the other sectors. And, you know, this has to change. Instead of spending $1 billion on agency staff, let's make sure that people are getting proper care. Let's make sure that they're getting pensions and that they're being treated properly in the way that they should.
Lisa, what can be done to fix this? We know that there's been a court decision, so people are going to get back pay, and it might hobble, actually, the government's ability to do other things.
So there's a number of things that need to be done. Firstly, the government has agreed to compensate homes, long-term care homes and hospitals, so that they can afford the wage reopeners that people asked for when Bill 124 ended. But they haven't provided the money yet for home and community care. So what we need is an all of healthcare sector approach where all healthcare workers, no matter where they work in the sector, if they do similar roles, they should be paid similar salaries. And that's not the case right now. So people go from home and community care or long-term care into hospitals because they can make more there. They need to have, they need to cap the agency rates in some way. And they also need to make sure that there's a licensing system with teeth that actually can prevent these agencies from sending in staff without the proper credentials, which is also happening in some cases. So they need to really look at the whole sector. And the other thing is the government has been spending a lot of money and spending a lot of time trying to improve the health human resources, but they often only focus on one profession. So, for example, the PSWs got a $3 increase per hour. But then the registered practical nurses that work at those PSWs now make the same or less than the PSWs in long-term care. That has created many registered practical nurses just like leaving the sector in droves because it's just not fair. Or some of them are actually asking to be demoted to be PSWs.
Lisa Levin, CEO of Advantage Ontario, and Jane Midas, staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Strawberries, spinach, kale, collard and mustard greens, and grapes. You probably assume you are buying really healthy food when you stock your fridge with these types of produce. But those fruits and vegetables are at the top of this year's Dirty Dozen list, the nonprofit Environmental Working Group's annual ranking of fruits and vegetables, which contain the most and the least amount of pesticides. The idea is to help us make informed and healthy choices when we're grocery shopping. Nicole Boudreau is a biologist at the Organic Federation of Canada, and Dr. Sylvain Charlebois is senior director at the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. They joined Libby for a conversation on Tuesday.
When it comes to food prices and food affordability, obviously we need an efficient agriculture and higher yields, and the use of pesticides, for example, is critical. I don't know if you saw the story yesterday coming out of Quebec. Someone actually found a scorpion in bananas.
Oh my God!
And the person was actually stung and had to go to the hospital. But the reason why we're seeing more of these things is the fact that, well, in Canada, we are expecting growers to use less insecticides and pesticides. And, of course, it's a rare occasion. I think we've seen scorpions three times in the last decade in Canada. But that's kind of the point I'm making, is that if we don't necessarily use chemicals, we grow organically, it's great, it's fine, but there are risks associated with that type of agriculture. And so we need to keep that in mind.
Yesterday, I paid $6.99 for blueberries, and then I was really worried about the $2.99 strawberries, and they have pesticides, clearly, and they also weren't that good. Nicole, what about the price?
I will speak as a biologist. If you consider the potential impact of a long time exposure to pesticide year after year, and also when you consider the combined effect of pesticides together, because when they analyze the use of one pesticide, if it is very low, okay, it may be okay. But the combination of different pesticides together, it can induce a chemical symbiosis that would be hard to neutralize. So my point is not to make it horrible, but it is that the environmental cost and the health cost associated with long time use of ingestion of pesticides, it may be a lot, you know, more expensive to the society. So I know it is an overview of everything, but I would also say that as customers now, we want to see, you know, blueberries in January. We have developed sophisticated manners in our diet, and the transportation and the intensive agriculture. So it is what consumers are demanding. Industry is trying to adapt. But from an organic perspective, I think that we need more research on pest control. As much money was spent on research on organic agriculture than it is on, let's say, conventional agriculture, maybe prices, pest control for organic producers would become more affordable.
Is there a way of washing the stuff that is going to take off pesticide? Because normally you rinse produce, but Dr. Charlebois, is that going to take pesticide off of something like grapes or strawberries?
Obviously, you need to wash your produce as much as possible every time. Even if you go to the farmer's market, I think it's recommended that we all wash our produce before consumption, for sure, to reduce risks as much as possible. But I would say, when you look at organic production in general, it is a much more simple model, and they are fewer, I would say, systemic risks. So, in other words, if you're looking at major farms that do produce a lot of food using pesticides and insecticides, they will produce cheaper food. But when something goes wrong, it goes terribly wrong. We'll see recalls, and you'll see costs go up significantly. Organic farming is much more stable from a costing perspective.
Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, Senior Director, Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University, and Nicole Boudreau, Biologist at the Organic Federation of Canada. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Rob in Scarborough phoned in during our segment on private agency nurses.
I have two nieces who are both nurses in hospitals. And what they have found is people have left. They go to an agency. They earn more money. They come back. And in one instance, one so-called qualified nurse turned to my niece and says, "What do I do?" And my niece was so frustrated, she said, "You're being paid the big bucks and twice as much as I am. You figure it out."
Sheila in Mississauga phoned in on Tuesday just before the Ontario budget was delivered.
I'd like to speak to tell the minister for finance, who's going to have a budget today. He is going to wear a new pair of shoes, yeah?
Well, and he's got work boots, apparently.
yeah. And it'll be paid by us, taxpayers. I need a new pair of shoes to walk, okay? But yep. Cannot afford it.
Yeah.
So are we going to have any changes done, or they are just going to play the game of the rich?
Susan in Toronto phoned about a firsthand experience with a public health clinic.
I had some elderly parents, and there was a nurse practitioner-led clinic that opened up a couple years prior. So I called them up, and they were taking new patients, and I signed my parents on, totally covered by OHIP. So So my mother now, you know, gets home visits by them because she's, you know, 90 and she has Alzheimer's. And they have a dietitian in that nurse practitioner-led clinic. They have social worker. And everything is covered by OHIP.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Jane in Toronto, who says suddenly Bloor West has become congested when it was fine before unused bike lanes were installed.
It's the bike lanes that are perpetually causing a traffic jam from Royal York on. And, you know, I haven't seen one bike today go by there. I live on Bloor Street in a condominium, and it's insane. It's traffic, traffic, traffic.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at @FightbackLibby. And call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.